I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hello, I'm Matt Kelly.
And I'm Matt D'Ancona.
And this is The Two Matts for week ending Friday the 8th of September. A podcast that doesn't just have opinions, we've got theories.
No, we're the Einstein of podcasts.
Are we?
No, but it's fun to say it.
I'll tell you what, it's nice to be back in the studio.
Isn't it?
The last few on Zoom, haven't we?
We've been doing them online and it works because of the interweb being so clever and that.
Yeah.
But I have to say that in real life,
it's nice.
Sir Matt D'Ancona is...
It's great because I can see you in your summer shorts.
And
you can see mine.
And you've got shorts and, you know, we're all just short-tastic.
Yeah.
And it's nice, you know, the summer has come to an end, the weather's still nice, and politics is really heating up. We talked about RARC and the concrete saga that seems to be engulfing the government, and we talked about the Rolling Stones.
We did. I went on and on about my admiration for Top Boy.
Yeah, absolutely. And
Didn't I?
Which made me want to go off and watch it, which I surely will.
Very good. So, what should we call this episode?
How about Concrete and Stones?
Concrete and Stones is good.
Okay, let's do that.
Okay, so this is The Two Matts, episode 12, Concrete and Stones.
Enjoy.
So, Matt, what are we going to talk about this week?
Well, I think we have to talk about the week of concrete, don't we? Or
yes.
More specifically, RARC.
RARC.
Which has become part of the national conversation. Aerated concrete would become something we all knew about?
To that point, obviously I was Googling through the news stories, and as late as June, it was being explained, you know, and let me remind myself what it is. It's reinforced autoclaved aerated concrete.
Yeah, which is
and it was being explained as that.
Yeah.
Now, of course, it's just
now
RARC.
Now it's just RARC, yeah.
And forever will be.
Which is one of those acronyms that just symbolises and has come to symbolise a lot of other stuff very quickly. And it's been an incredible week because, you know, it sort of broke after we recorded our last episode, and it looked over the weekend as if it was going to be big. It was obviously going to be big, but then Rishi Sunak comes back on Monday a bit bushy-tailed because he's done his mini reshuffle. He's moved Grant Shapps into defence, he's moved one of his old special advisors, Claire Coutinho, into energy and net zero, feeling good about that, and there'd been some surprisingly good figures from the Office of National Statistics about the economy. So you could tell he was feeling just a little bit, you know, I'm going to come back and let him have it. And this thing just goes, the concrete issue goes crazy. And not only does it go crazy, one of the reasons it goes crazy is because they handle it so badly. So on the Today programme on the Monday, Jonathan Slater, former permanent secretary at the Education Department, does an absolute drive-by assassination of Sunak, blaming him by name for not listening to officials in the 2021 spending review about this very issue about repairs of schools. And it obviously enraged
Sunak. And slashing the budget. Yeah, yeah.
And it obviously enraged Sunak because there was a pool interview that morning and he responded in a very brittle and tetchy way and said it was completely and utterly wrong. And, you know, thus breaking rule number one of of damage limitation in these sort of things, which is you have to put your hands up a bit and say, I totally get how worrying this state must be.
But nobody does brittle and tetchy like Rishi Sunak.
You're so right. I mean, he is, you know, in the Illustrated Dictionary next edition, under brittle and tetchy, there'll be a little picture of a man with slightly short trousers, right, peering over a lectern, being brittle and tetchy.
In Santa Monica.
So that was exciting. And it was turning into one of those days that one shouldn't enjoy but does, you know, where you're starting to enjoy it in real time, right? It's like, keeping an eye, this is getting amazing. And then Gillian Keegan, the education secretary, ups the ante in a spectacular fashion.
In a very Scouse way.
She is a Scouser. Yes, and part of me sort of warm, you know, there's not enough swearing in politics in my... But what she did was clearly inappropriate on the day, I suppose. So Daniel Hewitt, the ITV news reporter in question, had given her a hard time, and the interview's over, but the mic is still hot, and she does what every politician knows they shouldn't but often does, and she says, you know what, you've done a fucking good... Does no one ever say, you know what, you've done a fucking good job, because everyone else has sat on their ass and done nothing. Now, this was inappropriate language from an education secretary on the first day of term, but it was also very revealing, because the everyone else has sat on their ass was what would poker player would call a tell, because what she was really saying was all the other departments doing nothing. At that moment, the phones went crazy, because of course all the other departments are furious with her for having brought this problem to light. You know, the one thing one can, tiny thing one can put in the credit side of the ledger to her is she has at least started the process of, but almost every department in Whitehall is now in a state of panic, because this material has been used in, you know, care homes, barracks, courthouses, hospitals. In fact, our hospitals, there was a very good interview on Wednesday night's Newsnight with Meg Hillier, who's the Labour chair of the Public Accounts Committee. And I don't know whether the third Matt, our producer Matt Hill, can give us a little taste of what she's had to say.
I went to visit two hospitals with RAC, in one of them in Hinchinbrook in Cambridgeshire. The man showing us around was unable to go on the roof to check the roof. He was the man in charge of all the RAC programme, because he was 17 stone and therefore too heavy for the roof. In that hospital, they can't have overweight patients with needing bariatric surgery, for example, on the first floor, because then the bed, the equipment and staff will be too heavy. And at the weekend, the matrons on speed dial with the man in charge of RAC, because if they have a certain number of too much load on that first floor, it's dangerous and she has to keep in liaison with him.
So you've got nurses...
Madness.
..in real-time contact with engineers...
Yeah.
..checking that the floor isn't going to fall in.
Yeah, madness. Madness. And this is what confused me about, and I'm sure there's plenty of head teachers who might share this confusion.
Yeah.
Is how are head teachers meant to know whether they've got RAC from 30 years ago without getting structural surveyors in and stuff like this? You know, so when Gillian Keegan, who, by the way, I must say, and people will hate me for this, soared in my estimation when she swore.
It was a likable moment.
Because I just sort of thought...
It was real.
You're a human being.
Yes,
you know,
I
did. And somebody said, I think it might have been Alistair on The Rest Is Politics, said that he'd been told by a Tory MP, we've lost the election now because of this. I just thought, bullshit. You know, people actually will connect to that.
Yeah, no, it was a surprisingly human moment for a Conservative cabinet minister.
I also liked it, I think yesterday, when she said that all the photographers outside Number 10 were, quote, shit scared
of
her.
Yeah. Apparently they are.
So presumably our students and pupils all over the world, all over the country now have license to use the phrase as shit scared and fucking get off your arse and stuff like this. Because the education secretary
has said it.
But anyway, that aside, I did think, you know, it was unfair to start telling head teachers, you know, get off your arses and tell me, you know, whether you've got this material in your building or not, some of which will have been from 30, 40, 50 years ago.
Yeah. I mean, the problem is the level of uncertainty. So the kind of damage limitation strategy at the moment is to say, and the numbers vary, you know, 95% of schools are not affected. Well, that's a bit like going out for a meal and the waiter saying 95% of the meals in this restaurant do not give you botulism. You know, it's not really what you want to hear.
No,
and it certainly
right.
isn't what you want to hear where your kids are concerned. And so, of course, that's the problem. And to your point, the other thing is that we're all focusing on this particular kind of concrete rut, which is was only meant to last for 30 years. And it's been known for a very long time that there are problems associated with it, and successive governments haven't done anything about it. But it's also opening a sort of Pandora's box or can of worms, or choose your metaphor, because, you know, it's no surprise, surprise or news that the public estate in this country is very shoddily made.
Yeah.
And a lot of people who are in charge of these buildings or responsible for them are quite rightly aware that this is now going to lead to a big process of it. It's a little bit like parliamentary investigation, parliamentary expenses, but for the quality of public architecture. And I think that what you're seeing is 2022 was the year in which public trust collapsed with Partygate and Chris Pincher, who's resigned his seat, Tamworth, thus prompting another by-election. 2023 is going to be the year, is already the year, where trust in the public estate, the actual physical collapse of the public estate, happens. And I think it's a truly huge story, actually, which leads everywhere.
And to put it into Gillian Keegan terms, I think people are beginning to feel that it's just all a bit shit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it is all a bit shit. The potholes in the roads, the schools closing, the hospitals now under threat for closing. My point on this is that there are bigger stories that don't get the attention, that these smaller stories, I mean, I'm not underplaying the nature of this story. Obviously, there's 10,000 kids who haven't been able to start school, but that feeds into a much bigger problem, which is about the persistent absence of children from schools.
That's a huge issue.
That's the real story in education.
Yeah.
Is that we have
50% of special needs kids aren't going back since the pandemic.
That's 1.7 million kids in this country are missing more than 10% of lessons.
Amazing.
And 125? Hang on, I've got a note here. 125,000 of those kids are missing more than 50% of lessons. And we've got 95,000 kids in the country who just don't exist as far as
They've
school
just
is
disappeared
concerned.
From
disappeared.
The
system. Nobody knows where they are. Now, to be fair, Nick Gibb, the schools minister, is in the middle of an inquiry and an investigation, and they are recognising this as a crisis. In fact, I think Gillian Keegan herself called it a crisis. But this is the story, and I think this is where the media needs to do a better job, because RAC is a great media story. It's a great newspaper story. It's identifiable. It feels imminently threatening. It's got a lot of parents very hot under the collar for understandable reasons. But it's something that you can grasp quite easily, and it sounds like something, you know, out of a movie. You know, my God, the schools are going to collapse. But the fact that we've got 1.7 million children in this country who don't go to school on a regular basis.
Incredible.
That's the story.
It is a huge story. And I think that it makes you think about the whole range of education policy. I mean, my takeaway, sort of reverting to the physical side of it, but in a bigger range, is there are, you can link this to austerity, you can link it specifically to Gove cancelling the $55 billion building schools for the future Labour scheme in 2010, which he later regretted doing, and there's no doubt that's part of it. But I think it's also, there's something, people always talk about the British disease, and part of the British disease, I think, is that we just don't take care of our public realm, you know, in the way that other European countries do.
Yeah.
And there are deep reasons for that. I mean, one of them is that we often steal from the current account, the capital account, to pay for current needs. We prefer flashy new things, which actually often don't come to pass, to the boring but necessary business of making existing buildings livable then.
Mm.
And the final problem, and this is, I think, where we arrive at, come on, Keir, you know, what are you going to do, is that we don't raise enough tax. So I was very disappointed Rachel Reeves, I think, is a very good shadow chancellor, very reassuring, and I think she'll be a good chancellor. But she didn't have to rule out wealth taxes.
That's right.
And I think hats off to Hamza Yousaf, the Scottish First Minister, for saying we might have to, because income is falling in real value, but it's heavily taxed. Wealth, on the other hand, has been rising in the last 20 years exponentially and is undertaxed. And we're going to have to make a big decision as a country if we want to address all kinds of issues, not just things like climate crisis and social care, but just basic stuff like the school buildings being not actually, you know, too dangerous for children to go into. I mean, this is basic stuff.
Yeah.
And we've run away from it. And I do worry that I think the next election is going to be one of you know, the Tories trying to keep control of spending and Labour being very cautious. I do hope that if Starmer wins, as still seems, you know, probable, that in office he is prepared to say more radical things and be more honest about, you know, if you want a country like this, you have to be willing to pay for it. And hearing Rachel Reeves saying, I'm going to pay for it all out of growth, that's what Liz Truss said. That's what Liz Truss said.
So, you know, I mean, yes, I hope and pray that Starmer's got it within him, although I'll be honest, increasingly, as the days go by and the weeks go by, I don't see it. And I mean, there are two. I remember somebody, a good friend of mine, talking about the editing of a newspaper. I won't mention the newspaper, but he said that it wasn't the reason that this particular newspaper was moribund and boring wasn't a resource issue. It was a journalism issue. And I think there is a difference. You know, journalists always complain about, oh, we've lost all these reporters and all these sub-editors. And that's true. And it definitely has an impact on the quality of the product. But that doesn't mean that with the resources you've got, and I would, without wanting to blow too much smoke at my own backside, I think the New Europeans are case in point, where we've got tiny staff, but we are, I would think most people agree, are vigorous and interesting and aggressive and punchy. And you can do that just through journalism.
Opposite of the TARDIS, Matt. You're bigger on the outside than on the inside.
That's exactly right. Now, I think there's an analogue with politics. And I think you can... Vision doesn't cost anything. Inspiration doesn't cost anything. I'm not saying that fulfilling a vision and fulfilling the consequence of inspiration is free. It's not. But I don't see the inspiration and the vision with Keir yet. I see a lot of kind of game playing and soft shoe shuffling and defensive politics, and a bit of what we've called in the past pragmatic dishonesty, if that's what it is, you know, where he's messaging to a constituency of voters who don't want to hear that Brexit is a car crash, but we're hoping that perhaps Keir understands it's a car crash and there'll be remedial measures once he gets into power. But what I think we need in the country, and we've said it before, is somebody who can galvanise a spirit of reinvention.
Yeah,
because this country needs reinventing.
Totally. I mean, we've discussed this before, but will someone start the 21st century, please? Will someone press start?
Yeah.
Because, you know, all the problems we're dealing with now are really legacy issues of our failure really to move on beyond the legacy of the 20th century. And I think what part of it that's gone wrong in the sort of populist era is that politicians, and to a certain extent the media too, or certain sections of the media, infantilise the voters. And actually, if you look at the history of politics, great leaders often are the people that are remorselessly candid and make demands of voters, you know. And obviously Churchill's blood, toil, sweat and tears is the classic example. Also JFK's ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. Can you imagine a SPAD, a special advisor today, letting a cabinet minister go out and say,
it's on you guys,
it's on you, mate, you know? It wouldn't happen. Now, I think, and this is entirely intuitive, I could be completely wrong, but I think that when treated like adults, people respond like adults, and voters would respond well to a prime minister who said, this is not 1985. The needs of the moment are very different. You're living longer, which is great, but that means a different arrangement of how you treat your property. And it means if you want your children to be able to afford a property, we need to look at that and yeah. And we need to look at ways of how we fund what will inevitably be a growing public sector. You know, we're still in that mindset where privatisation good, public sector bad.
Yeah.
You know, and it's no surprise then that you have the old J.K. Galbraith division of, public squalor, private affluence writ large.
Yeah.
Which is not any good.
Yeah.
And I think a progressive prime minister, let's put it no more specifically than that, that had the guts to say that in terms, maybe not at the first conference speech, but not long after, and really set out, this is going to be hard.
Mm.
You know, we are pooper scooping for a long period of absolute bloody disaster after disaster. And the next prime minister will be.
Yeah.
Whoever they are, it will be doing that.
Why do you think, what is going on in Rachel Reeves' head then when she says we won't tax wealth? Because it's a perfectly sensible route one Labour strategy towards getting some more public finances to fix the things.
I don't think she should have said anything about it.
Why? What's going on?
It was the first time since she's been in the job
that
my dashboard started to flash. Because I thought, okay, I get it, you know. I mean, after all, Gordon Brown was reasonably to the left of Tony Blair, but he ran an iron sort of strategy before the 97 election, sticking to Tory spending plans. You knew he was going to invest like crazy. We didn't know he was going to make the Bank of England independent, but you understood that what he was doing was making it impossible for the Conservatives to say this guy's just going to tax and spend like crazy. I get that. So some of it, I understand. It's just good old-fashioned Labour centrist reassurance strategy. Fine. But you don't have to say things that you don't have to say.
Yeah.
And I don't think she had to commit Labour on wealth taxes. Just say, you know, I'm not going to do my first budget here, or we have no plans, or something, some one of those anodyne things, you know. But she didn't. She said, no, you know, I don't mean it in the... this is a denial. We're not going to do it.
Mm.
And at that moment, I mean, it's interesting. The LSE did a study on what a one-off wealth tax could raise, and it was $250 billion across 5 years. Serious money.
So $50 billion a year.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No,
250 over 5 years.
I mean, you can do
it.
Over
the course of the Parliament. Yeah.
And that was just a one-off...
Yeah.
You know, levy on the wealthy.
And think of the hospitals and the schools. I mean, let's talk about hospitals for a minute.
Because,
you know, that will be the next story. Like, I guarantee, but probably by the time we publish this podcast, they'll have moved from crumbly schools to crumbly hospitals.
Well, they've already written to all the trusts. So
you've got, you've got 41 hospitals that have been identified as having RAC, and 7 of them have got RAC throughout. So that's going to be the next story about closing hospitals.
The wonderful word they use in health world is decant patients. When you take a patient...
Really?
They
just pour them out? Tip the whole bloody thing up and pour them out.
I love that.
Just decant. To aerate them a bit.
Aerate them a bit, exactly.
Take the edge off the tannins.
Have you let the patients breathe?
And do they just elegantly put the empty hospital next to the decanter there?
Yes, with an aftertaste of nutmeg.
Nice, with the cork on the side. But the real story with the hospitals, again, you know, we've done the real story with the schools. The real story with the hospitals is this bloody 40 new hospitals that Boris Johnson promised, not just as an act of, you know, of altruism, because we have 6% fewer beds now than we did in 2015. Yeah. 6%
fewer
beds.
Amazing figure, which is a huge amount.
It's enormous. So you've had this decade of underinvestment, and the 40 new hospitals were meant to catch up. And we know they've built 2. They've got 5 under construction. Not all of them are wholly new hospitals, but 33 of them haven't even started, right, of the 40. And this is now, where are we, 2019? This is 4 years later. So that's the real story. And again, I would say, you know, if you Google this and ask, you know, 40 new hospitals and look under Google News to see how much coverage that's getting compared to the RAC story, it'll be a fraction, you know, 5%, 10%. But that's the bigger story. You know, the biggest fact that Keir Starmer should be screaming is not about RAC, but about the fact that we've got 1 in 18 beds fewer than we had 8 years ago, you know, at a time when the population needs more beds. And we've actually got 6% less beds. That's the story to me. And I just think that we, politicians and media, we're all complicit in it because we we seek these sugar rushes of a story that people can get furious about and then forget about. But the real underlying, the chronic issues around underinvestment in infrastructure, in education, in healthcare, in sourcing out social care, still not cracked by any means.
Oh, God, no.
About the whole question about what do you actually want the NHS to be? Now, so you're Keir Starmer. The, you know, the inheritor of the creators of the NHS, right, of that party, isn't now the time to have the big conversation about what the NHS should be in the future? You know, have that honest conversation. Wouldn't you have that as a central plank of yes. your government, looking after an older population? It's a core service that is in absolute crisis. Everybody knows it. Everybody suffers from it, unless you're wealthy enough to have your booper. Everybody's under the cosh from it. Why isn't Keir Starmer banging the NHS drum about how he's going to reinvent that?
And saying no more magical thinking.
That, exactly. And no more, by the way, sacred cows. No right. more the NHS is the best health service in no. the world, because guess what? On any metric, it isn't.
So, you know, move... Exactly. It would be a very good speech, actually, for him to give right now in the context of this crisis, which is... Boris Johnson was the absolute epitome of the magical thinking prime minister, promising 40 hospitals which have not come to pass. You know, if I become prime minister, I can't promise you I will, you know, turn this into a new Jerusalem in 5 years, but I will be honest with you and I will deliver on the things that I say.
Yeah.
It's incredible to say that would be a radical statement from a politician.
To hear somebody say, but, you know, I'm going to take the first steps
yes.
on a journey that will make this country a better place, not in the next 3 years, 5 years, maybe not even in the next 10 years, but in your children's lifetimes,
yeah.
you will see they will inherit a better place than we've got today.
You go back to JFK, who said, I can't remember the exact quote, but it's something like, we may not do it in the first term or the first 10 years, but let us begin.
Yeah.
That's so...
Take the first step.
Let us begin. You know, yeah. And I think what I want to hear from Starmer and people around him is not just, we're safe, we're reassuring, we know Tony Blair, it's all fine, but actually... We are going to be the best kind of risk takers, which is people who take the risk on reality.
Yeah. Liz Truss nearly got it right. It wasn't let us begin. It was let us begin. On that lousy, on the worst shell. On the worst joke you'll hear all week. Let's take a break and see if we can do more damage in the second half.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which... is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive and June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive and June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
So a little bit of podcast admin or housekeeping, as we call it.
Sam Harris. Technical.
Okay.
Housekeeping.
So, we're going to do two episodes a week, aren't we? That's the plan.
We are going to do two episodes a week.
And one of those episodes is going to be an answer, question and answer session.
Yes. Because it's all very well us trying to dispense wisdom on a weekly basis, but what we really want to know is what listeners and people who watch on YouTube want to know.
Yeah,
and if we can try and answer those questions.
And also, we've completely ripped off The Rest Is Politics, because that was their secret to success, wasn't it?
It was.
Q&A.
Yeah. So. I like to think they were the sort of early adopters. You know, they were Nokia to our iPhone, is so the way.
Thank you, Alistair and Rory, for
thank
the inspiration.
Thank you for getting going. We'll take it from here.
That's right. So, listeners, dear listeners, please email Matt any questions you like. Ask us anything at all. It doesn't have to be politics. It can be culture, anything at all, really. And the email we've got is 2matts, that's the number 2, M-A-T-T-S, at tnepublishing.com. That's T-N for November, E, publishing.com. And we will answer your questions.
As many of the questions as we can.
Yeah.
And, you know, ask whatever you want to ask and we'll do our best.
And it'll just be great to hear from you.
Absolutely.
So please do that. And this week's episode is sponsored by The New European.
Is it? I did not know that.
It did occur to me, because it's always sponsored by The New European, because we make it. And it did occur to me that some listeners might not know what the hell The New European is, because The New European is a newspaper and a website, but it's an actual newspaper, and it was launched in the days after the Brexit referendum in 2016 as a kind of pop-up publishing experiment, and railing against what we saw as the iniquity of Brexit. And none of that sense of iniquity has diminished over time. And I'm delighted to say that it has gone on and is succeeding and growing in circulation. And it's actually, as far as we know, it's one of the fastest growing newspapers in Europe, certainly probably the fastest growing newspaper in the UK.
Yeah.
And we've got a special deal this week for new subscribers, where if you join, you can join for just £1 a week for all of our digital content. Or if you like to get the newspaper delivered to your house every Wednesday as a subscriber, you can have that for just another £1 a week. So that's £2 a week. And we'll give you a free signed copy of Rory Stewart's new book, Politics on the Edge.
It's a real bargain.
Which is worth £25, I think.
Yeah.
So, and it's signed by the man himself. So that's this week's offer. You tell me, Matt, what do you think special about The New European?
Well, I can only speak personally in a way, but for me, joining The New European has been a bit like football coming home.
Great.
In this sense, I do think this. So obviously there's a, you know, you and I knew each other a little before, so I was excited to work under your editorship. But also the kind of rep company of writers at The New European is, you know, second to none. And you've got people that were already favourites of mine, like Patience Wheatcroft, Alistair Campbell, James Ball, Bonnie Greer, I think is terrific, Tanit Koch. You know, it's just Will Self.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm missing people out. But it's a really terrific lineup of people that I already had as must reads. But I think more than that, it's unique in the kind of media landscape at the moment, in that it understands that the world changed in 2016 fundamentally with Brexit and Trump and the populist movements around the world, and that the media needs to reflect this. And there's a very eclectic, you know, range of styles and views in the paper. But what is great is that it exists, to me, you know, there's a phrase in American politics, which is the first point you've got to ask yourself is, what time is it? What day is it? You know, and I think The New European really is happening now. It's aware that this is 2023 and we're not in 2001 or 1997.
Yeah,
and great. So it feels very vivid and but also a lot of fun. I mean, there's a lot of joie de vivre in The New European, and I like that. A lot of culture.
Thank you.
A lot of wit.
Well, I'm very proud of the culture section. I think that's
yeah, no,
that's
it's really
very,
important.
Very important, and lots of stories that you won't read in other newspapers and magazines. So anyway, listen, if you want to subscribe, and that's the best way to help us carry on what we're doing, you'll be supporting good, independent, honest journalism. That's the antidote to some of the corrosive nationalism you see in the right-wing media in the UK. If you want to subscribe, go to theneweuropean.co.uk/2Matts. That's the number 2, M-A-T-T-S. And like I say, every new subscriber will get a copy of Rory Stewart's brand new hardback book signed by the author, Politics on the Edge. And now back to the show. Okay, Matt, part two of the 2 Matts this week. What do you fancy?
Well, you know what? I'm feeling quite chipper today about the Rolling Stones, which may seem an odd thing to say, but this, for people who haven't seen it, they launched their new album, which is called Hackney Diamonds, on Wednesday. Mick Jagger, Keith Richards and Ronnie Wood at the Hackney Empire, and the first single, Angry, is a banger, and the Times said it's the forthcoming album is the best album the Stones have done since Some Girls in 1978.
Wow.
And it really is great to have them back, and I was just sort of thinking about the sheer time span of the Stones. So Mick Jagger is 80.
Is he really?
Which is the same age as Joe Biden.
Yeah.
Right? Keith Richards is 79, yes, which is the brilliant. Same age as Rudy Giuliani.
Brilliant.
And Ronnie Wood is 76, which makes him 1 year younger than Trump. So that kind of puts you in perspective. But what was interesting in the press conference they did with Jimmy Fallon, you know, weirdly coming over from America to interview them for the launch, they talked about their first ever launch of an album, which was in April 64. The album was called The Rolling Stones. It's a good album. I listened to it again last night. And it was launched in a pub in Denmark Street. Two hacks from the Enemy and the Melody Maker, pipe beer each, copy of the album. You know, Mick's like, oh, I really hope you like it. You know, that was it. Now, the important thing to... which I just blew my mind when Alec Douglas-Hume was Prime Minister that day.
That is amazing.
Right? Keir Starmer was 6 months old.
That is astonishing.
And it was 14 years until Rishi Sunak would be born.
Amazing.
I mean, just that, the longevity of these guys.
Yeah.
And they can, you know, they look at, you know, a bit shopworn and craggy.
I think they're having a
fantastic time.
Keith, especially, you know.
Oh, so yeah, it's really cool. And I think they love being Rolling Stones.
Yeah.
And they obviously missed, you know, they're sad that Charlie Watts is no longer with them, but they want to keep going.
And I think two of the songs on the new album
have got him on. And they even brought Bill Wyman back.
Did they?
Remember him?
Didn't he come a cropper for some... nefarious.
Well, he did.
He married young, didn't he?
The only problem was that he wasn't very young. He did an Elvis, as we say. I mean, again, to talk about the time frame in all of this, you know, I realise it's 33 years since I first saw them. You know, wow. I've seen them 8 or 9 times. It is quite an experience. And the interesting thing is that, honestly, they are still as energetic and fun to watch as they were.
So, confession time. I'm not a massive Stones fan at all.
Not everyone is.
And I think some of that is because I'm from Liverpool.
Of course.
It felt a bit like supporting Man United. You know, you were a Beatles fan if you were from Liverpool.
By the way, forced choice, I would always take the Beatles.
I think that, yes, okay. And I think that's reasonable.
The thing I think about it is, I think you're right. I think that the Beatles are dearer to the nation's heart. And I think what's interesting is that they have, you know, we've talked past about the Checkpoint Charlie things that make it through to the next generation. The Beatles have.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure the Stones have quite so
that's
much.
That's interesting.
Yeah, my kids are 20 and 22. The Stones don't really.
I think that's probably true of mine.
You know, whereas the Beatles, you know, absolutely, 100%.
Yeah.
Whether this, I think that there's an attempt here to try and stretch out a hand to the.
Do you know what Hackney Diamonds are, don't you?
Yeah, glass. Yeah, it's broken
shattered
glass
from the windscreen.
So, you know, they're trying to be well hard and there's something.
And I loved, because I was briefly in charge of the content of the Hackney Gazette, which is a great newspaper.
I used to live up there.
Great newspaper. And And they launched it by placing an advert in the Hackney Gazette.
It was wonderful, wasn't it?
And I'm not sure the Hackney Gazette knew when
knew
it happened.
What was going
it was
on.
Picked up by a music journalist. And now if you go on eBay, you can see copies
of
the Hackney
going...
Gazette, which is basically a free newspaper now, but being sold on eBay for 25 quid a time.
Well, it's a reminder of this, which is that in the same way that, you know, the Fab Four were the definitive Merseybeat band, the Stones were London.
You but know, they would never... this is probably the first time Mick Jagger's ever set foot in Hackney.
Well, if you know, I think that's not true. I mean, if you look at their early gig lineup, I mean, the first gig they ever did was in the Flamingo Club in Soho.
Okay.
And they had their HQs in Maddox Street. And, of course, they famous for the Hyde Park gig after Brian Jones died, I think, 79. You know, they all... And brilliantly, I mean, this does not speak to London authenticity, but all three of the surviving Stones have at one time or another had houses in Cheyne Walk, which I think is a
Did
very...
Did they?
Yeah.
That's great.
So they are a London band.
But Mick is quite a posh boy, isn't he, really?
Yes, he is. And the one time I met him was when I was editing The Spectator, and this was, you know, to make the story even more ridiculous, I was at the Cannes Film Festival, and he was there doing stuff over Shine a Light, the concert film they did, and I thought, well, he's bound to like The Spectator because he's into cricket and all that. So I went up to him and introduced myself. We had a nice little chat, and I thought, you know, in for a penny, in for a pound. So I said, well, Sir Mick, would you consider doing a diary for us? And he went, I don't know, I'm just not sure that, you know, my writing is good enough. And I felt constrained to say, look, you wrote the lyrics to Paint It Black, Start Me Up, and Sympathy for the Devil. I think you could probably stretch to 900 words, you know, of what I did this week. I'll give it some thought. It's a really kind offer, Matthew.
It's very good. Very good impression. Mate.
But and then he's not large, and he sort of tottered off to see Scorsese.
And did he ever do it?
No. I mean, and I knew he wouldn't, because they don't do it. I mean, I think they find getting up, you know,
enough of a challenge.
Well, I think, you know, why should I? Not because I think they can't, but sort of why should I? Is their kind of position on just about anything.
I really like Ronnie Wood painting. I think he's a really talented artist. Yeah.
He's, because, see, the interesting thing about Ronnie Wood is Ronnie Wood is still a Rolling Stones fan.
That's right, because he was late
outside.
To it.
Yeah,
that's right,
he was out. For, yeah. He was Rod Stewart's, you know, the faces and everything. So,
that's right.
But it's interesting because I occasionally with the Stones, I think, oh, you know, surely this pantomime has to end. Yeah. And then they come back and they do something which just adds to the joy of the nation a little bit.
It feels like, and you can trace this to other artists, you know, maybe ABBA. I mean, I'm not comparing.
No, I think that's absolutely right.
But ABBA, they went through a period of my God, they're everything, you know, in the 70s. And then throughout the 80s and 90s, they're a bit of a pastiche and a bit of a joke. ABBA, she's like, you know, pop royalty.
They're absolutely, you know, that. And I think what's also interesting, and we've talked about this a little bit in the past, is how pop has sort of changed its function in the culture. It started off as this thing which was Mayfly music. You know, it was ephemeral. It was meant to last 3 minutes and then disappear, be forgotten in a few weeks. But we've got bands that have had six-decade careers,
amazing,
right? And I do wonder whether music is where rebellion is to be found anymore. I would think that probably gangster rap was the last time that was the case. And if you look at the world now, world of music, maybe I'm the wrong age to know, but I'm not. I don't see music that makes me scared.
No.
And I think that suggests that the music has changed its function. Maybe that rebellion has gone elsewhere to identity politics and other things.
My children rarely disappoint me. I'm very proud of them all. But my daughter did disappoint me slightly in the car when she put on Spotify in the car a band called Cigarettes After Sex. Have you heard of these guys?
No, I haven't.
And it was like the most banal kind of lift music, kind of just...
it's a promising name for a band.
It was just dreary kind of stuff. And I said, are these guys big, you know, huge, you know, they sell out, you know, arenas and all of this business? And she said they're inspired by Radiohead, and I just snorted and I said, winding me up, this is like the most anodyne shit I've ever heard.
Anodyne is the word. I mean, whenever I see Sam Smith trying to shock me, I think, make an effort. No, but I mean, really, I know that the Daily Mail's every time Sam Smith comes out of his front door, the Daily Mail says, "Who will act? You know, danger to our nation's youth." Sam Smith is totally unmenacing.
The last time I was shocked by or sort of my attention was snapped into focus by anything really musical was that This Is America.
Yes, Childish Gambino.
Childish Gambino, which was like that video. I think is. You know, if you think about video installation, I think it's a masterwork, you know, an absolute masterpiece. And that was like, wow, okay, let's have some more of this, but not so much, you know.
I mean, it's interesting you mentioned Spotify, because I think part of it is that, you know, part of the rebellion of music was that it was not easy to get hold of and not easy to listen to. And when you did, it was an artifact. It was this wonderful 12-inch thing. I mean, Muggins here, what did I do last night? I went online and ordered the blue vinyl, you know, edition of the new Stones album.
Fantastic.
But that's because I'm 55, right?
Yeah.
The point is that I haven't really changed in that regard since I was 12.
Yeah.
And now you can get, I mean, it's a waste of money because when the album comes out, you'll be able to get it for free on Spotify.
That's right,
and so the fun
and
the sort of slightly subversive idea of creeping off to the independent record shop and buying Never Mind the Bollocks, you know, that's gone.
Yeah. What was the first single you ever got?
The first single I ever got was Hit Me With Your Rhythm Stick.
Ah, brilliant.
Injury.
And first album?
The first album I got was Live at the Hollywood Bowl by the Beatles, which is a
good choices.
Really, and I had a little mono player,
which
my parents had given, and I put it on, and it was like the sort of gates of heaven had opened.
Wonderful.
You know, hearing that sound of them, the crowd, you know, the mania.
Yeah, do you know what the best phrase I've ever heard in that sense of mind, instant mind expansion, was Charles Bukowski, the great kind of slum poet of Los Angeles, describing going into the LA County Library and picking from the shelf a book by John Fante, Ask the Dust.
Oh, great book.
And he said, as he pulled the book from the shelf, the library trembled. It's kind of like, you get those moments.
That's right. He's a great writer, Bukowski.
But, you know, on his gravestone, it's got an image of a boxer and just the words, "Don't try."
That's stealingly great. Good, isn't it?
And we don't try either.
We don't try. What did we talk about?
We didn't talk about, this guy on the run. Hopefully it'll have been picked up by the time this comes out, but maybe not.
But I mean, it's a sort of Netflix documentary in the making.
Crazy.
Extraordinary story.
I'll tell you what I can't understand. So he's in a lower category prison, Wandsworth Prison. Belmarsh is the high category place, where Julian Assange is locked up in Belmarsh, not going anywhere.
Not escaping.
Why isn't this terror?
I don't know. I think I think the phrase heads will roll, probably.
Probably, but it kind of storybook escape stuff, wasn't it?
It's incredible. I mean, it will be a podcast series or five, I think, this one.
The other thing we didn't talk about was the other Hackney story. The other Dalston story,
now,
actually. Top Boy.
You're watching this. Educate me a bit. I watched the first...
You did watch the first series,
I watched the first 2011-14 iteration, but not the recent stuff.
I mean, it's...
So I gather it's brilliant.
Well, I won't spoil it for anybody, because I do think it is some of the best TV this country's produced in the last... God knows, maybe ever. It's superb, and I think the acting is superb. But what is brilliant, because it's effectively a story of drug dealers in Dalston, and it's very brutal, and it's very in your face, and the language. What's interesting is the language. The scripting pays little kind of lip service to actually people being able to understand it. It's in this very kind of street language.
Proper
you watch it.
Yeah.
You watch it with subtitles. You know, want to know what's going on. And it is revelatory. What I think is admirable about it is that it is utterly grimy throughout. You know, there is no sense of glamour or romance about these people's lives at all. It is political as well. I've just watched the first episode of the new series, and a big part of the storyline is immigration officers turning up to throw out a young black man who was brought into the country as a baby and didn't have a passport, and I'm sure will turn out to have every right to be here. But the Home Office are front and centre of this hostile environment playing out. And it's brilliantly, brilliantly done. But it is, I mean, health warning, it is absolutely brutal. It's gory at times and very violent. But, I you know, if you haven't watched Top Boy, I really think... You know,
sold. I will, it's next on my list.
Get into
top
it.
Top of my list.
Good stuff. And the acting is magnificent. Anything else we didn't touch on?
Well, we didn't talk about Keir Starmer's reshuffle, but I think we kind of covered the the bases on that. On that, with
I think the world can do without the two Matt's commentary on that.
Yeah, especially the capsule commentary, the kind of T-shirt slogan version. Quite Blairite.
So thank you very much, folks. That's all we've got time for this week. Remember, our special deal, a subscription to The New European and a free signed copy of Rory Stewart's wonderful new book, Politics on the Edge. Just go to theneweuropean.co.uk/2Matts. That's the number 2, M-A-T-T-S, for that great deal. And there's a link in the show notes. Thanks, as ever, to the third Matt producer, Matt Hill at Rethink Audio. And until next week...
It's goodbye from me.
And it's goodbye from him.
Goodbye.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit YahooFinance.com, the number one financial destination, YahooFinance.com.